There's an old man here, Father Joseph. He ain't spoke in 45 years.
45 years? How can you live that long without ever asking a person one question?
I know not to ask any questions. Don't worry. I understand. Your clothes right here. Sorry.
A Polish rabbi makes his way through the Wild West with the help of a lovable bank robber. This week, we chat about a cowboy love story that was made decades before Brokeback Mountain, when the Sabbath really ends, and the stupidest piece of IMDb trivia ever. We also share our thoughts on Wonder Woman 1984 before finding out if the Frisco Kid stands the test of time.
Time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glutton. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Test of Time podcast, where we look back at movies that are at least 15 years old, and we ask, do these movies stand the test of time? That's why we call the podcast The Test of Time. Fun fact, I'm Alan Noah, and joining me on my video screen is...
James Brief. How you doing, Al?
I am doing just peachy, thank you for asking. So I hear that you saw Wonder Woman 1984. Should we talk about it?
I don't think it's necessary to really review the film. Definitely, I'd like to talk to you about what your impressions are about, you know, having seen this at home. Like, first, where did you see it? Did you see it on a big TV? Do you see it on your phone?
Oh, I saw it on the big TV. I would not watch this on my phone. I watched it with the whole family. My daughter's not really into superheroes in general, but she was excited to watch Wonder Woman. So we watched the first movie first because, you know, context and all that. And she really liked Wonder Woman. So then we watched Wonder Woman 1984 after, and she liked it. My son liked it. Courtney liked it. I really liked it. I've seen some of the critiques online about this and that. And okay, if you're going to say it's not as good as the first one, well, yeah, maybe that's true. I feel like that's usually the case. But I thought it was a very enjoyable movie. I love Gal Gadot. I would watch her in a movie where she just reads the phone book. I mean, you know, let's be honest here. Brrr.
Would you watch a film about her in a bank robbery?
Sure.
All right, folks, stay tuned. Eventually, we are going to see Fast Five, the fifth movie in the Fast and Furious franchise, confirmed by Alan Noah. Thanks, Al.
You know what? I'll just YouTube just the scenes that she's in. That's really all I'm interested in. I enjoyed Wonder Woman 1984. I would say my biggest complaint about the movie was that it just didn't have enough 80s music. You know, like, where's all the cool 80s songs?
The moment the movie ended, I asked my girlfriend, I said, I don't really get why that film was in 1984. Like, I was assuming there was going to be a big deal about, there's going to be something huge that happened in 1984, or she's going to make an appearance at the Olympics. I have no idea. I was looking forward to, like, you know, 80s films and, you know, over-the-top cheesiness. We got a couple things about the mall and stuff, but I didn't think it really took advantage of the 80s stuff.
I 100% agree. Yeah, like, a couple of jokes about, like, 80s fashion here and there, but... they definitely could have done more with that. I totally agree.
Right. Like, I thought at first they were still sticking with this whole DC continuity where no one's ever heard of Wonder Woman until the 21st century. So they're going to shoehorn in a little 1984 thing. And they did that for like a minute, like in the first scene, Wonder Woman saves some people in an 80s mall and destroys all the security cameras. But by the end of the film, she's on every television in the world.
No, she's not. She's not on camera.
Oh, that's right. That's right. She's actually not. You're right. She actually still is unknown technically to the world at the end of this film, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
But I'll say one thing I really loved about this film is they used one of my favorite scores. And they actually used a sample of it in the first Wonder Woman in actually my favorite scene. I think my two favorite scenes in both films are the scenes that have John Murphy's sunshine. The scene in the first film at the World War One trench, like when she walks across the battlefield, and then the scene where she learns a new power, has a very powerful score. That's John Murphy's Sunshine, and it's fantastic. It's one of my favorite modern scores.
Oh, it didn't really grab me, but sure. I thought Kristen Wiig was phenomenal. I thought Pedro Pascal was good. I think, you know, his role left a little to be desired for me personally. I didn't find him to be like a particularly like interesting villain, but I still like him. I prefer him as the Mandalorian.
You know, this is a word I don't think I've ever actually used, but I think it's the perfect way to describe Pedro Pascal's performance. I think it was very hammy, if I'm using that word correctly.
I think you are.
I loved his character. I thought it was sort of like an 80s, like, Biff kind of character with a little bit of, like, a Donald Trump kind of character, but nothing political like the President Donald Trump. More of, like, your 80s Donald Trump kind of guy. And I actually disagree with you on Kristen Wiig. I think she's fantastic. And I thought she was good as Barbara. I didn't think the Cheetah character really made sense to me. Definitely this film, like the first film, needed a script doctor. I had a fundamental problem with the Chris Pine character, but overall, I thought it was a fun film. I would have liked to have just seen it on opening night. I would have liked to laugh with people. There's a scene, I'm not spoiling it because it's in the poster, but there's a part where Wonder Woman has a special costume. It's just designed for the theater to start cheering. And I just thought it would have been fun. Maybe I just missed the theater, but I don't think I'm going to be super interested in seeing all these things just on television. Maybe it's just missing it for a year, but I'm very excited to go back to theaters after watching Wonder Woman 84. How about you, Al?
I kind of a little bit felt the opposite in that I was happy to see like a new big screen movie, but doing it at home didn't really bother me. I still felt like we had like the excitement of it's a movie night. Yay. What are we going to watch? And we watched a brand new movie. I don't know. I feel like it's still exciting to watch a brand new movie, even when we were watching it at home.
Even a comedy though? Like what about when a big comedy comes out? Like Ghostbusters or something big that's it's meant to laugh. You really want to watch that home? What if you're alone? I mean, I guess if you gather the whole family.
I definitely think that because I was with the whole family, like that definitely made it better. If it was a movie that like Courtney and the kids had no interest in seeing, and it was a movie that I wanted to see with you or, you know, one of my other adult friends, then yes, I would definitely think that seeing it at home would be a lot less exciting. You know, we watched Wonder Woman 1984 and Soul on Disney Plus. Those are both family-friendly movies, at least in my opinion. They're family-friendly movies. People might disagree with my decision to watch Wonder Woman 1984 with my kids, but I hear what you're saying, and I do feel like, yes, I do want to get back to a theater sooner rather than later, but, you know, it didn't really bother me watching Wonder Woman 84 from the couch, to be honest. But let's get into tonight's main movie. It's a movie that you requested. It's a movie called The Frisco Kid, and I had never heard of it, which I think made you want me to watch it more. Am I right? Am I wrong about that?
Well, I mean, I have a very, very consistent record when it comes to picking films that you've never seen for the podcast, in that I'm consistently picking films that range from you didn't like to you're actively mad at me for a long time for making you see this film. You know, you didn't like Galaxy Quest, and you questioned our friendship with a movie called Cube.
And Cool as Ice.
Well, come on. You didn't get exactly what you were expecting with Cool as Ice.
Maybe thereabouts. Fair
okay.
point.
So there's been this random film rattling through my head for years that I had seen as a kid. And Nobody talks about it, but I clearly remembered as a child that there was a Harrison Ford and Gene Wilder film called The Frisco Kid. And it was like a VHS tape that was in my house that, you know, eventually was just lost. And I just figured, let's throw this on there. I have no idea how this film goes. I have snapshots of this film in my memory from years ago, over 30 years ago.
I mean, I had never heard of it. And I think it's like shocking that I had never heard of it. Not so much that I'd never seen it, but that I'd never even heard of a movie that co-stars Harrison Ford. Like, I'm not saying I've seen every single one of his movies because I haven't, but I've heard of Regarding Henry. I know that it exists, even though I've never seen it. I had never heard of this movie. You asked me to not look up anything, to not read anything about it before I pushed play. When I did push play, I was like, whoa, Gene Wilder and Harrison Ford are in a movie together? And I've never heard of it? That's insane.
Do you remember how I sold it to you? I said, if you ask most people to name their top 10 films, the stars of this film are the stars of one or two of these films on many people's top 10 lists. You know, you're going to have a Star Wars or an Indiana Jones on most people's top 10 movies. And Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is on most people's, you know, top 10 films. And I'll tell you exactly why you've never heard of this film. I mean, we'll get into the box office. It didn't make much money. But the reason it didn't make much money, or I'll say it now, is a $9 million budget, and it made $9 million in the theater. For some reason, this film that came out in 1979, 2 years after the biggest film ever, and this is a time when Star Wars was literally still in theaters around the country, and they had a huge poster of Gene Wilder promoting this film. Maybe they were going on some of the Blazing Saddles kind of idea of people want to see Gene Wilder in another like Western-ish film. It was mind-numbingly stupid to do that. And interestingly, the DVD cover of this film, it's a blow-up of Harrison Ford's face, and Gene Wilder is in a little bubble in the upper left corner.
Right, I did see that. And it is ridiculous. It's ridiculous that they wouldn't play up the fact that Harrison Ford is in this movie after Star Wars was released, but it's also extra ridiculous because Harrison Ford's character in this movie is basically Han Solo. It's a very, very Han Solo-esque character. So yeah, they absolutely should have been playing that up.
I thought it was a very Han Solo mixed with an angry Indiana Jones. And you're right, like no one's ever heard of this film.
And because no one's ever heard of it, let's give our listeners a brief synopsis of what it's about. It's about a 19th century rabbi from Poland named Avram Belinsky, played by Gene Wilder, who travels across the Atlantic where he is to lead a synagogue in San Francisco. Shortly after arriving in America, Avram is robbed of most of his possessions, and he soon finds himself in the company of bank robber Tommy Lillard, who is played by Harrison Ford. The two unlikely friends trek across the country where they meet Native Americans, silent monks, and have other Meshuggah adventures along the way. So we already talked about how this movie wasn't a hit and how it kind of faded into obscurity. I do also just want to mention quickly that Gene Wilder was Jewish. He was raised Jewish. He said he wasn't particularly religious in his real life. He's still affecting the accent and everything of being Polish, but for whatever it's worth, he was in fact a Jew. So the movie starts off in Poland, and it begins with some kind of pretty slapsticky comedy where Gene Wilder is going to the yeshiva, that's the school for rabbis, and he keeps falling down and slipping on this ice. But he finds out that he's at the very bottom of his class, and he's being sent to the USA to lead a new temple in San Francisco. We should mention the movie takes place in 1850. So, you know, San Francisco is literally the Wild West. Avram asks where San Francisco is, and the other rabbi says it's by New York, which is a funny gag, because no, it's not. But I guess maybe if you're in Poland, from that point of view, it's closer to New York than Poland is.
Well, I'll tell you that having gone abroad a good amount. When people ask me, when I say I'm from America, they will quickly ask if I know somebody in a neighboring city to New York. And by neighboring city, it could be Miami. So, you know, really, most people do not know the geography of America like we might think they would. They probably know like where Florida is because it sticks out and that's where Disney World is. But most people are not going to point out stuff on a map correctly.
That's fair.
And certainly not in 19th century Poland.
Right, right. So Avram comes to Philadelphia and the train that he was supposed to take has been canceled. And so he meets this other man who says that he could maybe get him a ride, but he'd have to buy this wagon back from the man he sold it to. And that would cost $50, which in 1850 is a huge sum of money. And having never seen this movie before, right off the bat, I was like, ah, Avram's getting scammed.
Oh, yeah. They basically take Avram with them and they say, oh, yeah, we'll buy the wagon. We'll all go to San Francisco. But once they're out of the city, they quickly rob him, beat him. They pick up all his possessions and dump out what they think is useless. So his clothing. One other thing in his possession is a Torah, which is part of the Jewish Bible. So it's a very holy book to this rabbi. And
isn't it the whole Bible?
No. It's just the first five books. It's just Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. The whole Jewish Bible, that's the Tanakh.
Oh.
This is the Pentateuch, or the five books of Moses, the Torah. It's a book that it's very delicate how to make it. Even today, they could cost 5 to 6 figures for a Torah. So it's very, very expensive. It takes a long time to make. So it's a big deal that this community in San Francisco was going to not only be getting a rabbi, but he's going to be bringing a Torah with him. So luckily they throw out the Torah, but one of the robbers does steal one of the little ornaments that goes around the Torah because it kind of looks like a silver chain. And so now he's just penniless and he picks up his possessions and he just starts walking. And you could assume he's probably somewhere in like Western Pennsylvania, like Ohio area.
Right. Which is why then when he sees a bunch of men walking by and they are dressed in a similar manner to him, he assumes that they are fellow Jews. But like you just said, it's Western Pennsylvania. They are not Jews. They are Amish. And these Amish people, they treat Avram very nicely. They take him in. They think he's a little bit weird, you know, the way that he's speaking, because he's speaking to them in Yiddish. But they give him money for a train ticket. They send him on their way. It's not a train ticket to San Francisco because they don't have much money, but it'll get him to Ohio, I believe, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, and people that are not familiar with the Jewish religion, and rabbis in particular, there is a sort of demeanor, almost like a stereotypical sweet, wise rabbi. And the way that this guy talks, Avram, and the way Gene Wilder, he's such a good actor. There's a scene when he's leaving the Amish, and he just walks up to the man who gave him $10, which again, as you were mentioning, this is the 19th century. And he says, "It's all we can give you. I wish it was more." And he just looks to them and says, "I will never forget your kindness." It's not needed in this film, but it's such a wonderful character thing for him. He's a mensch.
Right. So he uses the money that the Amish people gave him to buy a train ticket. And while he's on the train, he doesn't meet Tommy, Harrison Ford's character, but they pass each other in the bathroom. While Avram's in the bathroom, Tommy robs everyone on the train. And then Avram comes out of the bathroom and everyone has their hands up and he doesn't understand why. And right before that, the little girl who was sitting behind him was playing Simple Simon Says, which we know as Simon Says. I guess we simplified Simple Simon Says, but he doesn't really get that it was a robbery and he doesn't really meet Tommy at this point. But knowing that that was Harrison Ford, we figure that we're going to see this guy again, which takes a little while. Before that, Avram gets off the train and he needs money. So he goes to like work on the railroad, like building the railroad. And this was a very slapsticky kind of moment where he's hitting the, I don't know what you call them, the ties, the railroad ties maybe, and he keeps hitting this one guy's foot. And he says, "It was an accident. I promise I won't do it again." But then he does it again. He's like, "No, I really won't do it again." And then he does it again. And he quits the job after just a couple days once he has enough money to buy a horse.
I love when basically the rivets are being driven into the railroad by five men, one at a time in a clockwise manner, driving a sledgehammer into the rivet. And these men are going, oi! It's very, very funny. So every time Avram hits it, oi! And they're very mad at him. But, you know, when he keeps hitting the big guy's foot. However, by the time he's asking for the horse, you can tell he's won these guys over. So he goes off and he winds up bumping into Tommy again. Avram happened to be trying to fish in a pond, and Tommy happens upon him and he just kind of helps him out. He shoots one of the fish that Avram was trying to fish. So they camp out and eat fish together.
Right. It seems like Tommy likes him, but, you know, they're going to go their separate ways because, of course, they would. You know, Tommy's a robber. He's not going to stick around with Avram. But then when Avram is, like, saying how he's going to get to San Francisco, he recites all of the directions that Tommy had given him. You'd go to this mountain and then make a left and then go, you know, this way. But he starts off going towards Mexico, and for whatever reason, Tommy feels bad for him and says, okay, follow me. And they go on together, which feels a little bit strange. Like, I didn't really get why Tommy decided to stay with him, other than pity, I guess.
You know, I was thinking about that through the film, and I was wondering, like, if I kind of missed something. Like, is there a reason he was supposed to go to San Francisco as well or something, and they're tagging along together? Tommy, yeah, he's a bank robber, but we eventually find out he has a good heart. And I think, you know, when you see somebody, you just know when someone's a good person. And I think a guy like Tommy is just used to saloons and generally scumbags and bad guys. And this is such a strange guy. He's not from around here. And I think Tommy's intrigued by this guy. And probably for the first time since his mother, there's somebody that he completely trusts. And he doesn't even know why he follows him, but he knows that this guy can be trusted.
Okay, fair enough. I'll buy that. There's a moment where they encounter a ravine, and Avram is saying that he thinks they could make it if they jump, and Tommy's like, absolutely not. That's crazy. Specifically, he says, I don't like the odds. I'm taking the long way, which Han Solo famously says, never tell me the odds. So when Tommy says, I don't like the odds, it just kind of made me smile. But then Avram's horse gets spooked because he sees a snake, and they do end up jumping into this ravine, and the horse is fine and Avram's fine. So then Tommy and his horse follow suit. That shot of them falling into the lake is pretty terrible. It's like slow motion and just it looks bad.
I do like that right before they jump into the ravine, he learns the word shit, like as a curse word. And Tommy's like, yeah, don't you have any kind of word like when you're really mad? And he goes, oh, oi gewalt. So when they jump into the ravine, into the water, Avram screams, shit. It's funny, but I love when Harrison Ford in full Han Solo screaming it as if he's running through the halls of the Death Star. He just screams, I give out! It's fantastic. I thought that was very funny with a horrible special effect. I agree with you.
Yeah, it's cute as they're picking up each other's language. So then they get to this town. Tommy says that he'll find us a place to stay. And Avram says, someplace pretty cheap. And that really bothered me because did they have to have the Jewish character say, get a place that's cheap? And I get it. He doesn't have a lot of money and he needs to pick a place that is going to be affordable. But he doesn't say, hey, remember, I don't have a lot of money, so let's find a place that's not going to cost a lot. He says, find a place that's pretty cheap. I mean, that is the number one Jewish stereotype. Then they say it again in the next scene once they end up staying in a place that looks like a barn. And Tommy's like, hey, this place ain't fancy, but like you say, it's cheap. I'm like, oh, did they have to bring it back and say it a second time, 2 seconds later? I feel like this movie does a very respectful job of treating Avram like a human being and not a Jewish caricature. And I really, really hate that they said cheap like twice in 15 seconds.
Yeah, to be fair, in that scene, there was another really nice line I liked. When he got to this huge open saloon city, it looks like one of these old West towns, and he just goes, what a wonderful country. There's no walls around your cities. There's no soldiers that come in from the next town, and they come and kill all of you. And it's a little bit of a joke, but I mean, this guy is in Poland in the 19th century. And if people don't know about this, like, Eastern Europe, there were these things called pogroms and just random killings of just entire towns of Jews whenever they wanted to. It is interesting that they put such an interesting line followed right by the the one you say. I didn't find it as jarring, but I see what you mean. It is that bad Jewish stereotype.
Yeah, it really kind of leapt out at me. But then right after that, then there is this big storm and Avram needs to keep going. He can't wait for the storm to pass, which is what Tommy is suggesting. And Tommy is saying, I'm not going with you. I am not traveling in this weather. It's crazy. I'm not going to go. And Avram keeps saying, okay, I'm not asking you to. If you don't want to, fine. He gives him like a little bit of a guilt trip where he's like, you've helped me pretty much so far. I mean, you're abandoning me when I need you most. You know, like he does a little bit of guilt. But, you know, he's genuinely not begging Tommy to come with him. And then in the next scene, there's Tommy with him. So again, it's like, okay, he really is drawn to keep going with him. And then they camp out for one of these nights and they're huddling up for warmth. And they specifically say, like, we're only huddling up for warmth, right? Yes, just for warmth. But I have to tell you, it crossed my mind at this point. I'm like, oh, is that why Tommy is going with Avram? Does he love him? Is there like romantic feelings here? I didn't really expect that that was going to be the case, but I was like, was this a gay cowboy romance like decades before Brokeback Mountain? Did that thought cross your mind at all? Or no, because you'd seen the movie, I guess.
No, not at all. And in the next scene, he literally says, I'm going to go get drunk and I want to get a word for a woman of the night with the biggest tits you can find. Not that that necessarily makes him straight, but, you know, the only thing I know of him is that he seems to have been attracted to several women he saw in a photograph, and he's happy dancing with women, and no, it didn't come across, but it's an interesting fan theory. But I will say, in that scene, when they're lying close together for body warmth, I was really cringing for a Test of Time gay joke. And when Tommy says, yes, we're doing this for warmth, and then Avram, instead of a totally out of place gay joke, he says, okay, then you could put your arms around me. And it was actually very cute. And they fall asleep arm in arm. It was just a cute scene.
It was. I agree.
The one thing I feel bad about is that, and I believe this was true in The Wizard of Oz, I don't know when they stopped doing this, but whenever I see an old film, and to me, the 70s is old, I just cringe and I really hope it's not asbestos in all of these snow scenes, because that's what it was in The Wizard of Oz.
Good point. I hope not, but Gene Wilder lived a pretty long life. I forget how old he was when he died, and Harrison Ford's still kicking. But in the next scene, they go to another town, and Tommy decides to rob a bank, because, hey, that's his thing, that's what he does. And they escape, you know, now Avram is basically an accessory. I don't think they use the word accessory, maybe accomplice, but Tommy is saying, you are in this now. You can't just like say, oops, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to, or I didn't rob the bank. You know, you were part of it. And they're fighting about this because obviously Avram is a religious man. He thinks that that's a terrible thing to do. And in one of their fights, Tommy pulls a gun on Avram. And I love what Avram says. He says, "Guns? You gonna shoot guns at me?" And he's saying guns. There's only one gun.
And that is great, like, Yiddish kind of English. Like, that's something my grandfather would have said. Because you don't say shoot guns at me. You might say shoot a bullet at me or shoot me. What, you're going to shoot guns at me? It's just not something an English-speaking person would say.
Exactly.
I saw in the credits there were two consultants. There were two rabbi consultants. And it's little things like this that I thought were, well done.
I agree. And then I also think, what did the rabbi consultant say when they heard the, "Be sure we stay in a place that's really cheap"? Did they say anything then? And they just ignored the rabbis then?
Let's assume that the original script called for something a lot worse. And that was the compromise.
Maybe.
So let's just go with that. But they're being chased by a posse, but Avram refuses to ride on the Sabbath. And it's interesting because even as a kid, I had a problem. I remembered this scene and I had a problem with this scene because you're always taught that, yeah, there's all these rules about, being kosher and this stuff. But you could basically break any of these laws if you have to save a life or, you know, if life is in danger. Like, I always thought it was interesting. Like, why isn't he riding? But I guess he doesn't think that either of their lives are right now worth saving because he really thinks that Tommy is a complete scumbag because it's one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. And, you know, Tommy is a bank robber. That's a pretty big deal to Avram.
Yes, and I can respect the fact that he refuses to ride the horse on Sabbath. But the thing that got me was that he has to wait for the sun to set. And there's this shot of them, like, eagerly waiting and watching for the sun to dip behind this one mountain. And then the second it disappears behind this one mountain, they're like, okay, now we can jump on the horses and go. I'm like, excuse me. No, that is not sunset. The sun has just dipped behind one very tall mountain. You can see as they're riding off, it is clearly daylight. Like, if you're going to stick by the rule, then stick by the rule, you know? If you're not going to make an exception, then don't make the exception.
Right. And it's a little bit, inside baseball here. But traditionally, Sabbath actually ends not at sundown, but when it's dark enough for there to be three stars out.
That's fascinating. I did not know that.
Yeah, that's the way some people do it.
I mean, in the Wild West in the 1850s, you know, stars would certainly be visible there. But that's clearly not what he waits for.
Yeah, it almost seems like if there was a really tall oak tree on top of that mountain, the sun would just have to go behind that oak tree and like it was sundown. So yeah, he stretched it as much as he could. But they immediately get on their horses and they make their getaway. But unfortunately, on the way, Avram notices he's lost the Torah. So he goes back, much to Tommy's protest. And Tommy's like, no, you can't do that. There's Native Americans here, and you're going to get captured by them. And sure enough, both of them do get captured by the Native Americans.
Yes, they do. But it's another one of those things where Tommy's like, I'm not going with you. I am not going to be captured by these Indians. He says Indians. They didn't say Native Americans back then. But he is adamant that he will not join Avram this time. This time he means it. Then it's a smash cut to there they are, tied up, being held by these Indians, Native Americans. And the leader of this tribe is asking Avram all these questions. And they have found the Torah. And clearly the Torah is important to Avram. And when he asks, if I ask you to walk on fire, but I would give you the Torah, would you do it? And Avram says, yes. And then the chief says, well, what if I were to let you go, but I keep the Torah? Would you accept that deal? And Avram says, no. And the chief is so impressed by his commitment to the Torah that he decides to let both of them go. It's really just based purely on the fact that the chief sees the strength of Avram's convictions.
Yeah, and the movie is incredibly, and I would say probably surprisingly so for this era. It's very respectful of a lot of the minorities, and the Native Americans could have easily been, you know, feathers in their hair, all kinds of shooting arrows, but it's nothing like that. When Avram says, "Why do they hate us? I didn't do anything to them." Tommy's like, "They've been screwed over by white people so much that they don't even ask questions anymore. They just shoot first, and they'll take your scalp." And, like, Tommy, he's afraid of him, but to the Native American chief's credit, he actually takes a moment to realize this is not like those white people. This is clearly a different brand of white people. And once he realizes this, he's not going to murder some guy just because of the color of his skin. He might murder him because he's with those, you know, those colonizers, but this is not one of those guys.
I agree. The chief is giving Tommy and Avram something that I wasn't sure what it was supposed to be. Was it peyote or ayahuasca? I assume, like, something that, like, seems like it's a drug. And Tommy's like, "Go easy on those." And Avram's like, "No, I like it. I don't know the recipe, but this sure is good." And then the chief is urging Avram to do a dance because then it starts to rain. And Avram's like, "I don't want to dance." But then he gets up and does dance. But then he, like, immediately passes out from whatever it was that they were eating.
Yeah, it's probably something like what you said earlier in this, when the chief comes to Avram and he's like, "Can you pray to your God to make rain?" And he's like, "Well, God doesn't really do that." And he's like, "Oh, so your God can't make it rain?" "Oh, yeah, he can." "Okay, so pray to him and make it rain." It's just not something he does. And I understand kind of what he was trying to say. And it was a little more philosophical, because the chief was like, "Oh, pray to your God." And he goes, "There's only one God. It's your God, too." And it was a cute scene. But I was just thinking another little Jewish thing, but there's a prayer that is said, like, every day by Jews that do pray every day throughout the fall and winter months, like, every single day, like, three times a day, a rabbi would know that they pray for rain.
That is interesting. I did not know that.
You never heard of the Amida? You know, there's that line, "Mashiv haruach umorid hagashem."
I've heard of the Amida. I don't know it that well, okay, to be honest.
There's a line that you add from Sukkot until Passover or something.
That's interesting.
No. Okay.
But after they dance and Avram passes out, they wake up in a monastery and everyone has taken a vow of silence, and Avram's not good at being silent and he can't shut up because he's just the kind of guy who talks a lot. And he asks for the salt to be passed at breakfast, and the silent monk who'd been taking care of him, when Avram says thank you, he says, "You're welcome." And it's like, "Oh, you're not supposed to talk." And to their credit, all the monks start laughing, and they, you know, they don't take it as like a horrible offense. They think it's kind of funny. I did think it was a little bit odd that a monk who had taken a vow of silence and hadn't spoken in 20 years would instinctually say, "You're welcome," when someone says thank you. That's something like we would do because we're used to talking, but like a monk wouldn't be used to that, right?
I don't think he's heard the word thank you in years, and I think it was probably more of an instinct. I love this scene, though. I mean, the end gag with the thank you, "You're welcome," that was funny, but he's screaming in this empty hallway, "Pass the salt." And then he keeps saying, "I'm sorry. I know I'm not supposed to talk." And then there's another, "Okay, again, I'm sorry." And it's like, shut up, just stop saying it. And I was laughing out loud. He's just naively innocent. I think he plays it well without coming across as stupid. Then there's a very fine line.
Yes. And in doing some research today about this movie, I was reading something that said Avram is basically a shlemiel, which is a fool in Yiddish, but it can also be not just like an idiot, it can be almost like a wise fool. And I was reading this very interesting article that was talking about this character as the shlemiel and why that's important in Jewish stories and also in all kinds of stories. And I don't know, I think that's sort of the way Gene Wilder portrays his character, as someone who is very earnest. He means well, and he makes mistakes sometimes, but it's never, ever malicious.
Yeah, it's interesting that he's described that way, because the opening scene of this film in Poland, you touched on it earlier, there's a slapsticky opening scene where he's kind of a bumbling fool. But that character, we don't see that really much at all in America. I feel like that might have been one of the original concepts, and then there are probably a few things they cut out here and there. He's more just naive in America. He doesn't understand how the Simon Says games work. He doesn't really know how to ride a horse correctly. But all these things are not really foolish. I think he's pretty wise in America, but I agree that back in the Poland part, they did play him off as kind of a buffoon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he makes mistakes in America. He trusts those guys that he clearly shouldn't. He thinks the Amish are Jews. He can't stop talking to the silent monks. Like, these are errors, but it's not because he's a moron. It's just because he doesn't know any better. And you can root for him because of that. He's a good guy. You want to see him succeed.
Right. And eventually, Tommy and Avram, they run into the robbers that ripped off Avram in the beginning, that conned him for the wagon. And Avram, at first he just confronts them to just give me back my money. I just want my money. And he takes the little jewelry ornament from the Torah back. But the guys beat him up, and they're about to smash his head in with a barrel of rum or something. And just as they're about to smash the barrel, Tommy comes downstairs, presumably from time with some lady of the night, and he shoots the barrel and saves Tommy.
Yes, and he also shoots one of the bad guys in the thigh. And then he's like, you know where the next one's gonna go. Get it? He's gonna shoot him in the dick. But also, he just shot this guy like in the inner thigh, and the guy is fine. There's no blood. He doesn't like keel over in agony. Don't you have like a main artery in your leg?
I didn't think he hit him in the leg. I thought he like shot him right between the legs, and he said, you know where the next one's going.
Oh, well, that would make a lot more sense. I could have sworn I saw like a shot of the bullet hitting his thigh, but maybe it just kind of grazed him. You might be right about that.
And the major artery is the femoral artery.
Oh, okay. Well, I assume then that you're correct, and he did not hit him in the leg. But then there's another scene where the two of them make it to the West Coast. They get to the Pacific Ocean, and Avram and Tommy are sort of like frolicking in the ocean and kind of wrestling a little bit on the beach, which again made me think, are there maybe romantic feelings here?
I still think they're just friends, and Tommy's never had a friend before. And as we'll find out, neither of them have ever had any friends. Avram has no friends in Poland. They were more than happy to send him to America. There's a great scene when they're just sitting by the fire right around this time. Tommy was thinking of just leaving after he gets to San Francisco. And Avram's like, how can you not be my best man at my wedding? And he's like, best man? Isn't that supposed to be one of your friends? And he goes, you're my best friend. You're my only friend. I think these two people are all the other one has. You know, Avram has a bride that he's never met. She's just seen a photograph of her. I guess you could call it a love friendship, but I think it's strictly platonic.
Oh, it definitely is. It definitely is platonic. I was just, the thought crossed my mind of, is there something more to it? But I 100% agree with you that there isn't. It was just a thought that crossed my mind.
Yeah, and that scene, they're on the campfire, and Avram says, you're my best friend, you're my only friend. That would have been the perfect time to answer your question earlier of why did Tommy follow him? And I thought that's where he should have said something like, you're a good man and nothing should happen to you. I didn't want to see anything bad happen to you. That's all, you know, kind of brush it off. But I think it's implied.
I definitely had that same thought, James, of like, this is where he would say, if he's not going to say, I'm in love with you, then maybe he would say, you remind me of my uncle. Or I grew up in a town where we had one temple and one rabbi, and that rabbi was special to me. Or my father always told me, you always treat a holy man with respect. Or something, you know, that there would have been some reason for why he stayed with him through all of this. but especially at the beginning, like that first time when he very clearly didn't know him at all and should have ridden off, this was the opportunity for them to have something, but they don't. Instead, what the movie does give us is the con men are back. They want to get revenge on Tommy because Tommy stole from them and, you know, shot at them in the earlier scene.
Well, he didn't really steal from them. He said, put Avram's money on the bar and get out of here.
Yeah, that's true. I think he took a little extra, though, didn't he?
Maybe he did.
Yeah. So Tommy shoots one of the guys, and then another guy is hit, but he drops his gun, and Avram has to get the other gun that fell down and basically shoot one of the other guys, or he's going to get this other gun, kill Avram, kill Tommy. Tommy's injured. He can't do it. And Avram, at the last possible second, shoots and kills this guy, and it's totally self-defense, but you can see that he is obviously clearly rattled, and this whole experience has, you know, messed with his mind, whereas Tommy's kind of like, what? Oh, you never killed anyone before, huh? And, you know, obviously this is a big deal for Avram, who's a religious man, and they get to San Francisco, and Avram is basically pretending to not be the rabbi. He, like, goes to the leader of the temple's house and tries to just drop off the Torah, and he pretends to be Tommy.
And he has a horrible fake American accent with a Yiddish accent. And he has this great line when he hands the daughter the Torah. She's like, oh, what are you giving me? And he goes, I don't know. I think it's some sort of Torah. That's just such a great line. Like, it's obviously giving himself away. And I mean, he could not look more like, I guess, your stereotypical rabbi, look, with his great beard and everything.
And at first, I didn't really get why he was doing that. But then in the next scene, he explains to Tommy, it's because he can't be a rabbi because he killed another man. And not only did he kill the other guy, but he didn't go to protect Tommy first. He went to protect the Torah first. And that sort of ties into what you were saying earlier, James, about like the rules. Yes, there are all of these rules about keeping kosher and keeping the Sabbath. But if life is at stake, you can disobey those rules if you have to. And Avram's basically saying, yeah, I should have immediately rushed to protect you, and I didn't. I rushed to protect the Torah, and he feels really guilty about that.
Yeah, I really love the way these two scenes played out, because I totally forgot how it ended, and I was really expecting Tommy to pull the trigger at the end, and Avram would be saved from having to make a decision of whether or not to shoot the robber. I really liked that Avram had to make that decision, because it was the right decision to make. And the next scene, when you find out why he doesn't want to be a rabbi anymore, and it's like, no, man, it was obviously self-defense, and you did nothing wrong. And then I thought that was, to the credit of the writers of this film, this is a clear mistake that Avram made. That's what pisses him off more than the killing the man. I think he's upset about that as well, but I think he's even more upset that he was more valuing a book over someone's life, and someone's life that he cares dearly about. So I thought that was fantastic.
I agree. I think it was really, really interesting, and I was only frustrated that then all of the people from the temple come in, and very quickly they're like, hey, are you the rabbi? To Tommy, because, you know, Avram already said that he wasn't the rabbi. But then Avram's like, yes, I am the rabbi. All of that stuff was so interesting and like so compelling of like this character who was so torn, and he decided he couldn't be a rabbi, which was all he was ever going to be. And then 2 seconds later, he's like, yeah, I am the rabbi. Like, they just kind of give that up really, really quickly. And it's sweet because all of these people are so excited by him and everything. But I don't know. I feel like they should have done more with that.
I agree. But yeah, eventually the jig is up and everyone's celebrating that the rabbi's here.
And while they're celebrating, one of the guys from the temple says, let's buy a round of drinks for everybody. And then one of the other guys says, wait, who's paying? And then the first guy says, "Yeah, we'll take it from the building fund." And then I really smacked myself in the forehead. I'm like, you had to do another cheap Jew joke? Really?
No, this was not a cheap Jew joke. This went into Bernie Madoff territory of, we're going to take money from all these people. They have no money. They're in San Francisco at 18, whatever. They gave their pennies for this building fund. Ah, I'm going to have some whiskey on it. So yes, it's all around a bad line.
Yes.
But it turns out that this woman, Sarah Mendel, that Avram was expected to marry, there's these scenes that are, I think, maybe unnecessary throughout the film that's sprinkled in that you are hinted that Sarah Mendel has her own lover. And so Avram's traveled all this way and he has no bride. But luckily, there is another daughter who happens to be much better looking, in my opinion. And she's single, and she is smitten by the rabbi as much as he is smitten by her. So this is a fantastic love connection.
Right. Unfortunately, then, the last of the three bad guys show up at this celebration, and he wants to kill Avram because Avram killed his brother. And, you know, obviously this is a kind of a moment for all of the other members of the congregation that their new rabbi killed somebody. And it takes a while for them to be like out in the street and yelling back and forth before finally Tommy says, hey, he shot him in self-defense. You were about to kill us. And then everyone's like, oh, that's good to know. And it's like, yeah, Avram maybe should have mentioned that.
No, I love that Avram didn't mention that. Avram is not immediately going into, but, no, it was self-defense. No, he thinks that this is just a terrible thing. Yes, technically he was probably okay by, you know, laws and everything, but he feels this is the worst thing he's ever done. It's a horrible thing, I presume, to end another human's life, even if you had to do it. And I think he's totally traumatized by it. He has no desire to defend himself from that act. It really had to be, and I think it's appropriate that it's Tommy that defends him and not the rabbi.
That's fair. That's a valid point. And Avram is so repulsed by the idea of killing, he refuses to duel with this guy, and he's not going to shoot him, he's not going to fight him. But when the guy like charges at Avram, Avram trips him, and then while the guy's lying on the ground, Avram says, here's the deal, America is a big country, I just traveled across the whole thing, I'll take San Francisco, you can have the entire rest of it, I just want to be here and I want to be left alone. I'm letting you leave. If you ever come back, we're not going to be so nice to you. And, you know, he handles this situation like a mensch. He's not going to kill him. He's not even demanding he be arrested or strung up or sent to the prison or whatever. He's like, just leave.
No, but he's leave with a little bit of force. He's learned a little bit. He's not confronting the Dalai Lama here, who's like, leave now, but I guess if you come back, I'm not going to fight you either. He does tell him, I can only be pushed so far. You come back and there will be problems.
Right. And then the movie basically just ends with Avram marrying this other daughter and Tommy is the best man. And you assume that they all live happily ever after in San Francisco. They don't say if Tommy converts, though.
No, they do not. And that's 1979's The Frisco Kid. Came and went in theaters, and no one's ever heard of it.
But so then we have to ask, does the movie stand the test of time? What do you think, James?
Yeah, I'm going to say that I've mentioned that I barely remembered this film. I just remember I kind of liked it. I just hadn't seen it in years and years. And basically, after I recommended this film, I started remembering a couple things. And I remembered, oh, God, there's a scene with Native Americans. This is going to be awful, isn't it? And I was shocked at how respectful this film was. I think for the most part, they treat Avram as a very, very likable character. And he happens to be a Jew. No. His Jewish qualities actually are very charming and likable. And, you know, there's that one bad line here and there. One thing I didn't like about this film, it's a two-hour film. I really think it could be an hour and 45 minutes. I think there's a lot of superfluous establishment shots. I like the dance scene at the end. There's parts where there's 30 seconds straight of just doing a dance. And like you chop these things here and there. There are a lot of parts of the horseback riding. I think you could have fast-forwarded, you know, and just jumped up a little bit. It wouldn't have missed much. But the film is actually, it's charming. There's a lot fewer out-of-date jokes than I was really expecting. And, you know, I have to say, it's kind of your typical buddy comedy of can't get across country, but now it's planes, trains, and automobiles, but it's in the Old West. These kind of films, they have elements that are all the same, but it really boils down to the cast and the chemistry with the cast. In this case, you happen to have Gene Wilder and Harrison Ford. I'm actually surprised. Not only do people not know this, but how is this not like a little-known film that Jewish culture shows to their kids? I think it's a very cute film. But I think this film does stand the test of time. It's a little film that should have done better than it did. It's not the best film ever. I think it's a very cute film, and I think it does stand up. What do you think, Al? Does this film stand the test of time?
I got to be honest with you. I was really on the fence with this one. I think that Gene Wilder's acting 1,000% stands the test of time. There's no question about that whatsoever. The article I mentioned before that I was reading, it said something about how at one point Gene Wilder was interviewed and they said something about like, oh, well, you've been in two classic Jewish film roles, with the other one being Leo Bloom that he played in The Producers, which is a movie we definitely have to do at some point in the future on the podcast. But Gene Wilder said, no, that guy in The Producers, he was Jewish-y, but in The Frisco Kid, he was Jewish. Like, he was the only real Jew that Gene Wilder played, according to Gene Wilder. And you can sort of see what he means. You know, like when Mel Brooks does a movie and there's a Jewish character, like the rabbi we saw in Robin Hood, Men in Tights, the fact that he's Jewish is basically just a punchline. And it's not in this movie. It is a core part of his character. He is steadfast in his beliefs. He has morals and principles that no one else in the movie has. And he's basically rewarded for that. You know, like all of the things that he adheres to and he believes in, you know, he's rewarded for. He gets where he's going. He protects the Torah. He still gets a wife promised to him, which is arguably sexist, but that's sort of how it works. So we won't get into that whole thing. It's an inspiring tale in a lot of ways. That said, there were things that bothered me. The cheap lines really, really irked me, because they stand out so much, because the entire rest of the movie was so respectful. To have shit like that in there really, really rubbed me the wrong way. And also, like, why Tommy sticks with Avram is not explained at all. And I don't think it's surprising that I thought that there was a romance there, just because why else would he do that? And, you know, I get that it's the blossoming friendship and everything, but there really needed to be some reason, especially in the beginning, why he sticks with him. I think that is a huge, huge flaw of this movie. I really wasn't sure which way I was going to go as we started recording, to be honest, which is not always the case. But I'm going to say that even though this movie has been forgotten, and you could argue, therefore, that it doesn't stand the test of time, I'm going to say that, yeah, just barely, The Frisco Kid does stand the test of time. And listeners, my God, I wish you could see the look on James's face right now. Oh, you are so giddy.
It's the face of waiting on bated breath. Like, I've been like, which way is he going? Because you really can't read him that well. Sometimes I think he's going one way and then he votes the other way. So, wow, we broke the curse, Al.
It was a curse?
Well, I guess every film I would suggest that you hadn't seen was an automatic thumbs down, Al. Well, I guess we broke the streak.
Okay, fine. Fair enough. I do just want to mention something that has nothing to do with if the movie stands the test of time or not, but I was looking up the movie on IMDb, and on the trivia page, I saw something that has to be the stupidest piece of quote-unquote trivia I've ever read in my life, which says, and I'm going to read it word for word, Gene Wilder sports a beard in this movie. Whoever wrote that, you do not know what trivia means. I mean, yes, you're right, but that's not trivia. That is not obscure movie trivia.
It's the kind of thing like you can only imagine someone who is being paid by the word.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to do it for us this week. Next week, I'm picking the movie, and I'm picking a movie that I know you haven't seen, James, which is not an obscure movie that no one's ever heard of. This is considered by many a comedy classic. We are going to watch This Is Spinal Tap. You've heard of it, right?
It's always been on my list, but I kind of want a reason to watch it. So I'm actually excited. Now's the reason to watch it.
Perfect. It's on HBO Max. I'm excited to get your thoughts on it. I'm excited to watch it again. I haven't seen it in many years. So don't miss that episode. Tune in next week. As always, we want to hear from you at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we'll see you next time, everybody.
Bye. Like a vault.